It's Thursday, April 18th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Canadian heist solved. The Grand Canuck gold caper foiled in the end. Chief Nishan Duryapa, who oversees the community of Peel, the area bordering Toronto to the west, lays it all out.
Exactly 1 year ago, 6,600 gold bars weighing over 400 kilograms were stolen from Pearson International Airport here in Mississauga and Peel region. It had a value of over $20 million, and this particular theft has become the largest gold theft in Canadian history.
Over 400 kilograms, about 900 pounds, and $20 million Canadian, that's $14.50. Quite a haul for the nine thieves. Wait, I'm being told it's $14.5 million. Now that is some real green or gold. How are the crooks captured? Sergeant Mike Mavetti explains.
At 6:32 p.m., the suspect arrived at Air Canada Cargo driving a five-ton truck.
That's 6:45 p.m. American, but it's still 5 tons. It's 4,500 kilograms Canadian.
The suspect was carrying a fraudulent airway bill as he approached the warehouse. The image you see is the actual airway bill that the suspect produced. The airway bill is for a legitimate shipment of seafood that was picked up the day before.
Legal seafood. They executed the Air Canada gold heist thanks to having a fish on the inside, much like the Stuffed Scrod special available for $24.99 at participating Red Lobsters. But this was no fluke, my friends. Nope. But this was no fluke. It was Air Canada about to get catfished. And that's how the investigation got its name.
The investigation has been dubbed Project 24 Carat.
No, no, that is terrible. That is just a terrible generic name. You have so much to work with. You have seafood. You have Canada. You have gold. How about Operation Smelt Night? Works on two levels. Or Ducket, Ducket Goose. Ducket, Ducket Canadian Goose. I was still workshopping that when I came up with the simply elegant solution, Operation Goldfish. Forget operation names easily. Have the memory of a goldfish. You won't forget Operation Goldfish. Anyway, while I was busy figuring out operation names, they were catching the thieves. Five of them, including a man nabbed in Pennsylvania in a rental car with 65 firearms, but no garish bracelets or freeze-dried skunjili. But at least four others are still on the lamb or the lobster, if we're sticking with the seafood theme. Among the still at large is an Air Canada employee, so it was an inside job. Or as ABC News says,
in what appears to have been an inside job.
No, that's not how you say it. It's not an inside job. It's an inside job. It's not like as opposed to an outside job, such as operating a seafood warehouse or stealing gold. But you know, I knew something in this case didn't smell right, and it's not the year-old flounder. It's that Canadian officials said they believe that, quote, the thieves have melted down the gold, and then the profits they got from the gold they used to help finance the firearms, clearly not understanding how far $14 million can go on the U.S. firearms market. But this idea that they get the gold bars, they take it to a smelter, they melt it down, they turn it into cold, hard iron as they deal these guns on American and Canadian streets, well, I have to say, the legal concept of whoever smelt it, dealt it, will finally get put to the test. This was the sixth largest gold heist in world history. And in the Canadian heist rankings, the incident outranks the time when, this really happened, 9,500 barrels of maple syrup were stolen and replaced with water. That case of stolen liquid gold was worth under $14 million. And if they'd have used a fake bill of lading indicating a calamari pickup, they would at least have a great code name, Operation Sapsucker. On the show today, we deliver for you a full show, because this gives us time to consider a fully formed idea, a great idea. What if we began to proceed parliamentarily? Professor Maxwell Stearns asked, if we overhauled our wacky, incoherent, dysfunctional American system with a method that's been tried successfully all over the world, Max Stearns is a professor of constitutional law and economics at Maryland. He argues in his new book, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy, that the solution to so many of our problems is to A, correctly identify the problem. And that means we got to look at the two parties that are tasked with doing too much and therefore wind up delivering too little. He lays out the exact constitutional amendments that could turn this whole ship around. We got to go a little more parliamentary style in his analysis, but it's going to work. These ideas are good. They're hard, but good. But we can do hard things, I say, as does Max Stearns up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So as you know, my listeners, I have done politics and I've done sports as a professional broadcaster, and the overlap has always been fascinating to me. One huge difference, and where I think sports is better than politics is something to actually report on, is that sports actually have scores and statistics, and so exceeding expectations doesn't matter if you lose by 12. It's called beating the point spread. Another aspect of sports is there's a lot of data. So with politics, there's just one or two elections every quadrennial, and you could tell whatever story you want. With baseball, you get up to bat four or five times a day, and if you whiff too much, it's pretty much reflected in your statistics. But here's another underappreciated difference, and I was thinking about this when I was reading the new book by Maxwell Stearns, Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Sometimes rule changes, well-intended rule changes, even good rule changes, subtle rules, rule changes or prominent rule changes so fundamentally affect the sport in ways we don't even realize. So when we think about who's a good basketball player, what comes to mind might be someone like Steph Curry. But without the rule change of the three-point line, this guy, who is a first ballot Hall of Famer, I would say would not even be in the NBA. And there are other changes like that. There are changes about just the traditions, for instance, of how to swing at a pitch and whether to go for the home run or not strike out, which to prioritize. And that totally defines baseball as we know it. So there's an analogy with politics. We all know that the Electoral College was a rule set up by the founders, and that greatly affects everything about presidential elections. And then there are rule changes that have been implemented by tradition, and so there's more like swings in baseball, like, say, the Senate filibuster, that also greatly influences the very definition of politics in ways that maybe the people who undertook the rule changes could never understand. Well, here, arguing for some radical new rule changes to meet the radical crisis of our times is Maxwell Stearns. He is a professor at the University of Maryland, and he joins me to talk about what's wrong with our system and how to fix it. Welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a lengthy intro. I don't know how much of a sports fan you are, but I don't know if anything resonated with you.
No, I liked it very much. It just makes a lot of sense.
It's harder to change the rules of our Constitution, but you think it's necessary. So take us through there. I know things aren't good politically, but as someone with an expertise in law and also the long view of history, tell me why we're not in a blip of a moment or things just go in waves and we could expect to have a normal politics followed by this abnormal politics and this dysfunctional politics that we're currently living through.
So I begin the book by explaining that we're really in the third constitutional crisis as a nation. The first, of course, is when we displaced the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution that we more or less presently operate under. The second was in the lead up to, during and in the aftermath of the Civil War, during which we amended the Constitution with the three Reconstruction Amendments. Reconstruction tragically ended far too soon to effectuate the objectives of those amendments. And we are in the third constitutional crisis now. And this crisis is similar in some ways, different in others. Each crisis has its own unique features, but they all have as a characteristic feature a profound divergence or disjuncture, if you will, between the premises of the system under which we are operating and the vital needs of governance and society at the time in which the crisis occurs. And what we're experiencing today is an ever-widening divergence between the two parties to the point where we no longer regard those with whom we disagree on certain issues as having evaluated the same materials as we do, but in good faith coming out the other way. Instead, whether we're talking about politics or society, we regard those who disagree with us as either lacking basic intelligence or as evil. And the centers of these two parties or ideological camps are moving further and further apart. That's not impressionistic. There is data that shows it. And there's a clear set of reasons having to do with our Constitution meeting the information age.
Well, we've always, correct me if I'm wrong, but we've almost always had a two-party system. There were times, of course, the election of 1860, the Republicans come in, the Democrats are fractured and factionalized. I don't know if you would call those different versions of the Democratic Party distinct parties, and then the Whigs are replaced by the Republicans, but it's always been two-party. We've had crises, as is noted in the fact that you're calling this one the third crisis, but the two-party system hasn't been the crisis thus far. What about the recent period makes the fact that we only have two parties the crisis when it wasn't the case during the Roosevelt administration or any other time post-Lincoln?
So you're certainly right that we've had a two-party system largely from the jump. You can go back to George Washington's farewell address to see this. That's pretty early on in our history, obviously. And we've put up with the two-party system. We may have thrived in spite of it, not because of it. But In the information age, two fundamental dynamics have really affected it in a profoundly negative way. One of them has to do with hyperpartisan gerrymandering, and there's a really important book written by David Daley, former Salon editor, and with Fair Vote, formerly with Fair Vote.
He's been on, yeah.
Called Rat Heft, right? And the intuition.
Rat fucked. He says, you can say it, rat fucked.
it's your show. but in any event, the idea was that Republican operatives realized that for pennies on the dollar, they could throw money at below the radar races at the state level, flip enough states that are purple and blue red. And because the state general assemblies draw the House of Representatives district lines, they could then take control of the House. And they thought they had a lock on it for more than 20 years. They were a little bit excessively ambitious. But the general idea of what we call red mapping or blue mapping on the other side is that our representatives choose us, we don't choose them. Well, another way to think of it is that these elections are no longer competitive. That's not quite true. They're not competitive in the general election.
Yeah.
They are competitive in the primary cycle, but the
right.
consequence of that is to make them more, make the red states more red, the blue states more
right.
blue.
They're competitive, but the only dimension that they're competitive on is how much more to the left the
exactly.
Democrats can be and to the right the Republicans
and then
be,
the
essentially.
Other, yeah. Exactly right. And the other dynamic has to do with the manner by which we receive news and news-like content through social media, which also tends to further push us into two competing camps because the business model of social media, whether you're talking about Facebook, Twitter, or any other, is to keep people actively engaged, glued to the screen as a lure to advertisers. We don't do that by giving folks up the middle, thoughtfully balanced stories. We do it by giving them content that actually sort of reinforces their sense that they're on the righteous side of history or allows them to condemn the other side as being on the wrong side of history. And this synergistic loop between the media, politicians, and the electorate is pushing our modes further and further apart. And this is a fundamental change that requires substantial reform and a willingness to sort of question the foundations of the rules by which we play the game. In this case, not sports, but in politics.
So I want to get to your solutions, but I totally agree. In fact, the gist pretty much lives its life as a corrective to at least the media part of your critique. So we have this problem where the primaries over-select for extremism and the media doesn't reflect any sort of moderation, centrism, or shared reality. But the solution then becomes, and we'll get to the good parts of the solution, an embrace or a way to breathe into being more of a parliamentary system and less of a two-party system. Why, if those are the problems, can't we, why isn't it plausible to say, since we've always had a two-party system and it's worked more or less functionally until now, why don't we address the fact that the political parties are gerrymandering states? I mean, there are ways to do that within the system rather than have a parliamentary solution. And I don't know if we can address the fracturing of the media by some laws, but I do think that if the problem is that the media is fractured and everyone gets to choose their own reality, if we have multiple parties, then essentially what will be lost is the New York Times, for instance, won't have to say, well, we have to be maybe not everything to everyone, but we have to appeal to what would be the Liberal Party, what would be the Green Party, what would be some faction of the center-right Republican Party. So a place like the New York Times would start saying, okay, our constituency is just the whatever it would be, Labor Party. And then you'd get newspapers like you do in England, where they don't really try to be all things to all people. So I put a lot on the table. But in general, the question is, why is the solution to have more parties, not to just reform the situation that we have by other means?
So there are roughly three questions there, if I have them right.
And I
hope that you'll let me know if I've failed to answer any of them. Let me start with the first. So the idea that we could just fix gerrymandering, for one thing, we'd actually have to amend the Constitution to do it because the Supreme Court has literally green-lighted in the Rucho case the power of states to engage in hyperpartisan gerrymandering, declaring that it is a non-justiciable political question. So at that point, we would be enacting an amendment to solve a symptom of the crisis we're in, but not actually the root cause of the crisis that we're in.
Well, we'd have to amend the Supreme Court if the current constitution, if the current members of the Supreme Court are the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, in 20 years, given demographics or, I don't know, packing the court, there might be a different solution other than an amendment. But please continue.
Well, I mean, it's a fairly recent case. I don't think Rucho is going to be overturned anytime soon. But even so, even if that were not the case, what we need to do is create a system that actually breaks the pathology of our two parties. And the pathology of our two parties is that because it's a two-party system and because the margins among between the parties are so close, neither party can afford to relinquish getting along with or going along with or acquiescing in the most extreme demands of their base. And so we have to figure out a solution to those political pressures. And one of the centerpieces of my book is to take the readers on a virtual world tour to England, France, Germany, Israel, Taiwan, Brazil, and Venezuela to show them what does and does not work in terms of facing down dire threats to democracy, which we're presently facing. And the reality is that one of the lessons from the World Tour is that there are two real threats to democracy, two sets of seemingly opposite features of democracies that don't face down the threat very well. One is when you have too few parties, majoritarian systems, like the US, like the UK, think Brexit, or on the opposite side, where you've got hyper-fragmented parties, too many parties, think of Brazil, think of Italy, think of Israel. And the central lesson is that successful democracies tend to make choices on two dimensions. One, how they elect their legislature, typically lower legislative chamber, and how they elect and hold accountable the head of government. Because if you don't make choices on those dimensions, you're not going to be able to give third, fourth, or more parties a valuable role in governance, which is the key to breaking the deadlock of two parties. And it's also the key in avoiding the problem of hyper-party fragmentation. These seem like they're opposite, but they're really the same. Because in both cases, a small minority can either take control of one party in a two-party system and then roll over the government, or can get more support than any other party in a hyper-fragmented system and then begin rolling over the entire parliament to take control of the government. So you have to achieve that sweet spot, which political scientists think is roughly between four and eight parties, and there's a way to do that, and that's what I propose in this book. Let me make a comment on media, though. I actually love the idea of having greater competition in media that isn't targeting the extremes of our society. Because one of the things that my proposal will do is change the nature of campaigns. Imagine that you're in a coalition-based governmental system, a multi-party democracy. In order to win in that campaign, you can't succeed simply by denigrating the other side as lacking basic intelligence or as evil. You have to be able to campaign on a platform that says, I disagree with this other party on some pretty significant matters, but I can work with this other party because I can also find lots of areas of common ground where we can be jointly committed to the project of benign democratic governance. And so there'll be a market for media that actually isn't targeting denigration, but actually is much more likely to look for areas of consensus across different groups. And that's not by admonishing media to act better. It's not by admonishing politicians to act better. Admonitions don't work. People respond to institutional incentives. And so what we have to do is diagnose the pathology and then figure out what the problem is and create benign incentives that overcome the pathology. And what we need is a multi-party system with not too many parties, but not too few. And that is going to motivate better political behavior and a better media culture.
So what are your proposed amendments to get there?
So my proposed amendments are three. One is how we're going to elect the lower legislative chamber. This is a system that's adapted from what's known as mixed member proportionality. Picture this: every 2 years you go into to vote for the House of Representatives, but instead of casting one ballot, you cast two. One ballot's going to be just like we have now. You're going to vote for a districted candidate for the reasons I previously explained. Those races will tend to be dominated by two parties because your goal is to keep your side intact and fracture the opposition. Your second ballot is going to be by party. And then what we're going to do is, on a state-by-state basis, we're going to use the proportional party results to come up with proportional representation for each state's delegation to the House of Representatives. And this time, when you vote for third parties, you're going to be rewarded, not punished, for doing so because of the Second Amendment, which is the most radical of my amendments. Instead of having voters directly
vote, is the Second Amendment in the current Constitution, but please continue.
Well, it's not that Second Amendment. My Second Amendment, not our yes. Second Amendment. So the book Second Amendment changes how we elect the president and vice president by allowing up to five parties in descending order of proportional representation in the House, the leaders of those parties to negotiate until a majority coalition forms, and then the party who succeeds in forming a majority coalition, its pre-designated slate for president and vice president will assume those offices on a fixed calendar, so we avoid the problems of indeterminacy associated with some problematic parliamentary regimes. And then the final amendment solves a problem that we've had from the jump, which is that the impeachment clause has never succeeded in actually removing a president. One could quibble about whether Richard Nixon resigning is the successful example. We could talk about that. But finally, we'll have a viable mechanism of removing a deeply problematic president through a vote for no confidence based on maladministration, subject to a 60% vote in the House of Representatives. So it is less demanding than impeachment, but more demanding than simple majority votes, so that wouldn't simply arise from mere policy disagreements, but would arise from a serious maladministration. And what these combined amendments would do would be effectuate change on these two axes of democracy: how we elect the House, how we select and hold accountable the president. And what this would achieve is that sweet spot, the Goldilocks principle: more parties than two, but not so many parties that we are hyper-fragmented. We would roughly end up with between four and eight parties. And when you vote for a third party, think about this. Let's say you're a progressive Democrat and you vote for the Democrat in your district election, but the progressive party. When the progressive party says to the Democrats, or say the GOP, we'll join your coalition, but here's what we demand in exchange: you're going to give us policy concessions, you're going to give us cabinet appointments, the first seat that becomes available on the Supreme Court, that goes to us. Suddenly, you are rewarded, not punished, for voting for third parties. And those parties, as I previously said, in order to succeed, they can't be pure ideologues. They have to campaign on a platform of, I may disagree with these other parties, but that doesn't mean I can't do business with them. It doesn't mean we cannot engage benignly in the joint project of governance. And that's going to have profound benign effects in our politics, in our elections, and in our culture.
Well, they can be ideologues. I mean, if they get enough people to vote for them, or, you know, let's say, trick the electorate or appeal to the electorate to get a couple of seats on that slate, they certainly could be pure ideologues, right?
Well, they certainly could. And that means they're not going to play the long game effectively, because pure ideologues aren't going to compromise to negotiate with other parties. And they will eventually move off the radar because of their lack of success in favor of political entrepreneurs that actually give their constituents something of value other than feeling self-righteous but not accomplishing anything. And that's as it should be. Unsuccessful ideologues should be unsuccessful. Those that actually can deliver for their constituents should be successful. That's the way politics should play out.
Right. As opposed to the current status, which is they're entrenched. No one has any power to do anything anyway. So just the role of the gadfly or the burr in the saddle, or the person who's constantly complaining but appeals to their electorate, or just the primary slice of their electorate, the few thousand people who even come out to vote, they stay in power, or at least stay in office forever and never get anything done. That's essentially the current.
Because you can't give them up. I mean, that's the problem, right? You can't give up the part of your constituency that is embracing deeply problematic you know, sort of views and policies and actually obstructing your ability to get things done. As we saw, for example, with the debacle with Kevin McCarthy stepping down from Speaker of the House. Everybody knew if we get the moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans together, they could come up with a solution to that. But there's no institutional mechanism because the goal is to keep your side intact and fracture the opposition.
We'll continue our conversation with Max Stearns after the break when we talk about the amendments that Max suggests would help the political system. And we're back with more from Max Stearns. So of your three amendments, they'd all be opposed by the current political parties because their power is entrenched and they wouldn't want to give up a hold on power. A couple of them certainly seem to have surface level or immediate first glance appeal. I think a lot of Americans really bemoan the fact that third parties are all but impossible under the current system. And then you patiently political explain to them why it is or isn't. And then you have a solution that breaks through. So I could see many Americans embracing, yes, let's have more political parties. The one amendment, and I suspect that it's in there because of how it interacts with everything else, is the more easy removal and impeachment of, I suppose, not just a leader, but you'd have to extend that to other cabinet officers. And I think that the first glance reaction—
I don't extend it to other cabinet positions. It's literally just available. I just want to be clear. As a vote of no confidence based on maladministration of the president. Now, of course, if the president's removed and the vice president, because I keep existing line of successions, others may come in succession and you could apply it to them. But no, I do not change the impeachment clause. I do not change the 25th Amendment. I do create a mechanism specifically targeting the sitting president.
Given that our current, at least, ways of applying the law give the president more leeway under the theory that he's the president, they have to be able to operate in this extremely important job without, say, being prosecuted. This would seem to me the only rule or law that holds the president to a much different or higher standard, or would more easily remove the president from office than any officers below the president. Am I right about that?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, for one thing, the idea is that we want to have the president fulfill the vital functions of that office. And one thing that I try to avoid, and I try to avoid, I succeed because I avoid it. I do not give a legalistic definition of maladministration, but I do go through some history of the Clinton, the Obama, the Bush 2 administration, Bush II administrations, and of course I talk about Trump too, to illustrate particular manifestations of behavior that readers may or may not regard as rising to the level of maladministration. But I want to be clear, it's still a pretty high bar. If you think about it, let's assume that you have a coalition at 50 or 55% of the House. You need 60% to vote no confidence, which means you have to get some members of that original coalition on board, which is to say it's not going to be based on a mere policy disagreement. And the goal here is not to exercise this power and begin removing presidents. The goal here is to ensure that whoever it is occupying the most important office in the nation and maybe in the world actually is fulfilling her or his functions properly. And as a result of having this accountability, it is in fact true that we'll actually end up with greater accountability, but also a greater sort of assurance that the person occupying that office will fulfill the vital functions of the presidency.
So I have some problems with this. Some of them are, I don't think it's an easy sell to the public, as I think your other two amendments are. As a headline, we're going to make it easier to remove the commander in chief. I think a lot of people who are currently invested in the political system and even have critiques, valid critiques of the political system would say, well, that's just going to inject more chaos. And what we actually need is more stability. Point one. Point two, when I look at gubernatorial efforts of recall, they don't seem to, in general, comport with the the greatest ideals of good governance, right? They're often knee-jerk, and I don't know if we're generally better off with the states that allow for that than a state that doesn't, just wait till the next election and vote that person out of office. So I don't think it's appealing to people. I think it does inject a bit more chaos. And third is, I know that you, and you're aware of this, and you talk about the limitations of a theoretician predicting what would happen. But of course, all these rules, as even if they're well designed, are to be implemented by man or human. And humans are humans, and they're going to be venal, and they're going to have self-interest, and they're going to perhaps twist these laws and ignore the definitions of maladministration, just as they are now by, say, impeaching Mayorkas on essentially maladministration charges when so much case law says you can't do that. So what about, once again, I've given you three things to comment on, but I'm sure you've heard these critiques of the easy administration of the president. What say you to them?
So, I'm trying to break your question into the multiple questions. Let me just say, so I think the gubernatorial analogies don't quite work because the gubernatorial systems in the states are operating on a two-party system. So I think one of the issues is you've jumped to the Third Amendment without taking into account necessarily that we're talking about in the context of a thriving multi-party system, which is going to change the political dynamics. So I think you're assuming that the existing problematic pathologies will pervade the multi-party system, when in fact, the multi-party system will abate the pathologies that you're assuming and embedding into the third rule. So I actually think we will not get more chaos. I think we will get far greater stability, because we're going to have leaders who are going to realize that the mission is not to denigrate the other side, but actually to work with multiple parties through a consensus scheme of coalition governance. I think you will get greater stability, not lesser stability. And I do keep the fixed four-year term, terms, two-term limit for the presidency, existing lines of succession. So, you know, look, the idea that men are venal, right? Like, you know, we can go back to the Federalist Papers for some nice quotes along those lines. But the reality is that people operate in the context of the incentives of the institutions. And what we have to do is come up with better institutions that produce more benign incentives to change the game, going back to your opening about the sports analogy. And that's what we need to do. And I'm convinced that the proposals I advance in this book will, in fact, create far better incentives, because it will create far better institutions that will motivate, frankly, more benign and less venal behavior.
What's the history of political scientists who study a system and propose changes, broad sweeping changes, and those changes eventually are adopted or come to pass? Is it a glorious history where we could say mostly the political scientists have steered us in the right direction?
Well, first off, I'm not a political scientist. I'm a constitutional law professor who also studies economic analysis of law, including the economic analysis of institutions. And the reason I wrote this book is because, frankly, there are lots of political scientists, there are lots of media commentators that recognize we're in crisis and have proposed a number of proposed changes, ranked choice voting, multi-member districts, term limits. And I looked at these things and I realized that they don't have the pathology right. And as a result, our conversations are being dominated with proposals that, number one, will not actually fix the crisis we're in. Number two, cannot be enacted, or most typically, both. So let me say this. The proposals I've just mentioned translate into unemployment acts for members of Congress. And a lot of people out there think the thing to be avoided is amending the Constitution. It gets it wrong. We've never had a constitutional convention under the Constitution, but we've come very close twice within one or two states in the 60s and 80s. It takes two-thirds of the states or two-thirds of each House of Congress to propose an amendment, well, to create a convention and propose an amendment, or two-thirds of each House of Congress to do so, and they have to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. Obviously, an exceedingly high bar. But imagine we actually have a constitutional convention. And imagine the convention starts throwing out the kinds of proposals I've just mentioned. suddenly my proposals become a critical pressure release valve that Congress can enact that, unlike all the other proposals, actually allows every sitting member of the House and Senate to keep their job in their existing district or state. So when we talk about the fact that the parties will be threatened by this, who are the parties? The people who lead those parties. And the people who lead these parties, if we are at the inflection point of inevitable constitutional change, which will happen because we're looking at two colliding trains minus the certainty of when the crash is going to occur. This is the only set of proposals that allows members of Congress to keep their jobs and also to claim to be the heroes of democracy. And you might not like them. I might not like them. It doesn't matter. Let them be the heroes of democracy. We actually need a set of proposals that will truly fix the crisis we're in. Mine does it, the others don't, and that can actually gain the support of those who have the power to prevent reform from being enacted. Mine does it, the others don't.
Right. So I apologize if I implied you were a political scientist. What I meant was...
I don't take it as a negative. Actually, I take it as a compliment.
Yes.
I take it as a compliment. Somebody reads my book and thinks I'm a political scientist by training.
There's a lot of political science in there. But what I was doing was trying to evoke, teeing you up a little about that famous or infamous 1950s E.E. Schatzsnyder paper where the Political Scientists Association of America said, what we need is more ideological polarization or parting among the parties. That came to pass, not because the political scientists endorsed it, and that led us to the situation we're in now. And then you referenced ranked choice voting, which to me, I think is perhaps a pleasant little frippery that doesn't really change much. That's about the best thing I could say about it. It's benign, I think, at best. But, you know, it took a lot of effort. It took a lot of there was a lot spent on it to try to get it to pass, and it doesn't really do much. And then I think about the other thing that you mentioned, which is which are term limits, and they've been bad. And here in New York City, you can't even work with your local council member because they're elected once, you get to know them, they get reelected, and then they're lame ducks. It's a terrible system. My point being, the unintended consequences point. And the experts look at this to amend the system. And I think we've had a rather bad history of it. Now, I know you're going to say that doesn't mean that other better, correct analysis reforms should not be taken just because we've gotten them wrong in the past. But that is how I see it. And from reading your book, that's how I see you see a lot of the past efforts of reforms proposed by very learned people.
So that goes to why I structured the book the way that I did, actually. So I totally agree that just coming up with some theoretical construct is profoundly problematic because you don't know how it's going to play out. What we need to do is look around the globe and see what kinds of democratic systems face down threats to democracy effectively or not. And political scientists generally agree that the system that's the gold standard is the very one that I propose. This is not coming up with some construct that hasn't been tested. In fact, the United States system is the construct that hasn't been tested. Ask yourself this question. If you're testing the wisdom and soundness of a system, whether we're talking about an engineering system, a business model, whether we're talking about a musical genre or anything else, would you say that the ultimate test is, can I find a single example that has actually survived longer than any other? Or would you say the ultimate test is, has this system been benignly replicated again and again and again across cultures and societies? I think virtually anybody would say the latter, not the former. And our system of two-party presidentialism remains a recluse on the world stage. We have never successfully exported it. But MMP has been benignly adapted around the globe across different cultures and systems. So actually, your critique is my point. My point is that it is a mistake to just come up with a theory and then claim that we should change things. What I'm saying is no. We have to get past American exceptionalism and actually imagine we might learn from millions and millions of people in the experience of many, many countries throughout history across the globe. That's what we have to do. And what I'm proposing is not some untested theory. What I'm proposing is based upon the benign experience that actually has pretty broad consensus among people who have studied comparative systems. And so this is not some pie in the sky idea. This is grounded in reality. And it is actually grounded in the reality of nations that have either successfully or failed to face down their own threats to democracy. It's a distillation of learning across comparative systems. So this is different. Now, I'll go back to the 1950s for a moment. So in that period of time, APSA writes this report that you alluded to that says the major critique of the parties is that they're insufficiently distinct. Think about this. In the 1952 presidential election, the Democrats and Republicans both went after the same person to head their ticket, Dwight D. Eisenhower. 5 years later, an economist named Anthony Downs writes a book called An Economic Theory of Democracy. You probably never heard of him. You probably never heard of the book, but everybody has the model of that book in their minds. It's the single line, liberal to conservative, and the idea is if we have extreme candidates on each side, eventually they converge on the center, what's called the median voter. And everybody has that model in their minds, and yet they all know it doesn't describe our politics today. And that's not impressionistic. If you look at the Pew Research data, from the early 90s until now, what we see is not a standard distribution of voters, which is what's required for ranked choice voting to work. Instead, what we see is a bimodal distribution with the centers of the two parties moving further and further apart, wreaking havoc with our politics and wreaking havoc with our culture. And if we don't get the pathology right, we will not come up with the appropriate course of treatment.
Max Stearns, Maxwell on book covers, is professor of law at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law and the author of Parliamentary America, The Least Radical Means of Radically Repairing Our Broken Democracy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-gee-puru-doo-puru, and thanks for listening.